and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in. Henrik here. Always a pleasure having you with us. This is Red Ice TV, and today we are interviewing Ricardo Duchesne, who's back on the show again to talk about one of his latest books, Canada in Decay. It's actually ended up on the bestseller list up in Canada. It's trending number one still. I'm looking forward to diving into the book more, talking a bit about some of the new focus that Ricardo has had. Welcome back, Ricardo. Good to have you here again.
Yes, I'm glad to be talking to you again, Henrik, and it's true, my book was released in August of this year, well, 2017, and it has been consistently ranked number one in various topics in Amazon Canada, in politics, in immigration, and other subjects, so that took me by surprise. I thought that it would be ranked for maybe a month, you know, my audience might be purchasing it and some other people, and it would perhaps until October, but it is there, and it just surprises me, and quite high, the ranking, so I'm very pleased about that, and I encourage your viewers, even if they're not Canadian, to purchase it, because this book is specifically an effort to explain why it is that diversification was imposed across the West. It's not just Canada. I said from the beginning that to offer an explanation of Canada's multiculturalism would be incomplete, because this is a phenomenon, as you know, that is transpiring, and it almost transpires simultaneously in Australia, New Zealand, the United States. These were all nations with immigration restriction policies. And all of them almost simultaneously began to abandon these policies and to open themselves to the world. And soon afterwards, Europe did the same. So from the very beginning in the book, I say we need an explanation that addresses this general phenomenon that doesn't just explain Canada. So I think your readers would benefit from reading it.
You know, I've been interested in the northern nations, if I can call it that way. Of course, I'm Swedish. I'm from Sweden, and we struggle with many of the similar issues to Canada. Is that for some reason the northern countries have kind of decided to try to outcuck each other, for the lack of a better term?
And I mentioned Sweden quite a few times. I have some long footnotes looking at some of the trends and statistics of what happened in Sweden. The same for Germany. This is something that has always been a preoccupation of mine. I'm not just talking as a Canadian nationalist. I'm really talking as a person who cares about every Western country. If I had been living in Portugal, or Spain, or Greece, or Sweden, I always say to myself, I would have been doing the same. Because as you know, I wasn't born in Canada. So in many ways, I am a nationalist of the whole Western world. I am a cosmopolitan person in the old-fashioned sense in which that term was understood by Enlightenment thinkers, and not in the way they have transformed the meaning of that word today to mean that you are for every culture, every religion in the world. No, I'm very much a pro-Western nationalistic person.
Very good. Yeah, exactly. It's just interesting watching these nations and the way that they're going about suiciding themselves slowly. And of course, we're fighting hard to try to prevent that. We're trying to waken people up. We're trying to make them realize why this is being done to them, and also the effects, the negative effects of what's going to happen to them when the demography changed to such a degree that the first world values, the Western values that we hold, basically goes out the window. So we'll return to the book in a little bit, Ricardo, because we want to focus actually first in this program a little bit on three personalities, if you will. And we were talking a bit back and forth before we set up the interview here, of course, and there was three people that came to mind as kind of steam valves. I'll explain this in a moment, but it's Jonathan Haidt. That's right.
I say Haidt, but I'm not the person that one should be trusting on accent and pronunciation.
Yeah, there it is. Haidt. I think you're right. Jonathan Haidt. And then, of course, we have Steve Pinker. And then finally, but not least, Jordan Peterson. This is an interesting article actually out of the New York Times talking about the Jordan Peterson moment. And they're basically, these have been launched as kind of celebrities that are on the periphery of the, how do we put it, the defense of Western civilization. And my idea about these people has been they're great because they bring attention to a lot of the issues that are traditionally forbidden within the politically correct discourse.
Yes.
But at the same time, I believe that they're there as kind of people that basically can say here but no further, right? If people have concerns about PC culture, about multiculturalism, about the attack on Western values and the insanity at universities to not, you know, leave that out, then they can go to these people because they're enough in the mainstream. So people can find them easily. They can find their works. They can listen to their videos and kind of, I don't necessarily mean this in a negative way, but get stuck on these people and never move on forward. And I know, Ricardo, that you have your critique of these people, these three people, for that reason as well. Should we begin talking a bit about Haidt, Jonathan Haidt?
Let's go with Jordan Peterson.
Okay, sure.
I have an article. Yes, I have an article that came out some 10 days ago, if I recall, and it was picked up by Countercurrents. And Jordan Peterson, as you know, he's a superstar right now. I don't think I can recall, either now or in the past, anyone who has gained this kind of popularity. Possibly Noam Chomsky. But in the case of Peterson, his popularity really goes well beyond academia, even beyond politics in some ways, because he appeals to people that are outside academia. He has a kind of self-help, psychological element to him that has been very popular. So Jordan Peterson is an important intellectual to talk about because of his prominence. He came into prominence, I would say, about 3 years. I mean, it's not that long. And he has a book. I was kind of surprised when I had not been checking him hardly up until this summer only. And when I checked him, I realized that he really had only one book in the field of psychology, which is what he teaches. And then he had come up with something about the Bible recently, and now he has this book, which is a bestseller across the board, the 12 Rules book. So he didn't have a major intellectual standing in the scholarly world, but there is no doubt that he is a great speaker. He defended his views with clarity on the issue of gender pronouns. There's some of his lectures are on YouTube, and you can find them easily. And he appears to be a person that can lecture quite well, keep the audience, his students, listening to him all the time. So he has to be given credit for being able to articulate to a large audience ideas that in the academic world are not accepted. I would add this too as well, that Jordan Peterson, in many ways, is a mainstream conservative. He's not saying things that are very risky or dangerous to the establishment. But the academic world is so pathological, it's so way out there, that even when you say common sense things, conservative things that were accepted by many people, even many academics 20, 50 years ago, are now seen to be radical or extremist, outright, and so on, when in fact he's not saying anything like that. One of the things that I aim to do in this article that I posted in my blog, you can find it there, is to address the issue of Jordan Peterson and identity politics. I think you read the article, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a long article. And because Jordan Peterson has been asked whether he's an outright person and has been accused of being an outright person. And when people say outright, they mean, are you into white identity politics? Are you a white nationalist? And he has said in a very clear way, no, I'm not, and he really is not. And in fact, he has said that he really opposes identity politics. He opposes both left identity politics and outright identity politics. And he seems to equate them both. So one of the things I did in this article was first to contrast the identity politics of the outright and the identity politics of the left. I argue that the identity politics of the left is in many ways temporary. They mean to say that right now, in the world that we are living, blacks, for example, are racialized. That means they're not treated fairly. They're discriminated against. There is institutional racism. And so if we're going to remedy that situation, we have to have identity politics. We have to get blacks to be aware of this reality, that they, as a group, are discriminated by society. Therefore, they must address this issue as a group. But their aim is to create a society in which blacks are not discriminated, in which they're just individuals like everyone else. The same goes for all kinds of sexual identities. They're not saying that people should be permanently divided along sexual and racial lines. They mean that right now the situation is such that it is necessary for them to address the grievances they have, the inequalities they experience as a group, because that is the only way they can improve society. So that was one of the first points I wanted to address in that article. The other one was that really Jordan Peterson is into identity politics. If you examine the logic of his argument as to why there are differences between men and women, and he says they are clear biological differences, then he's saying that if you look at a female individual and at a male individual, you don't just judge them as individuals. You have to be aware that you can group them as males and you can group them as females because males and females have different behavioral tendencies, psychological dispositions. He's not saying that we should have affirmative action for females or affirmative action for whoever, whatever sexual inclination you have. So he's not against or he's not for the leftist identity politics, but he's certainly taking a political position. He's saying that the leftist identity politics is not correct because a lot of the differences you see in society are an expression of these biological differences. Therefore, that's a political position. But he's also saying, and he's speaking to males and females and saying to them, you know, you're not just an individual. You belong to the category male and you belong to the category female. So to me, that's a form of identity politics. But when it comes to white identity, then he pulls back right away. And so you can see there that his rejection of identity politics is not an all-out rejection. It's a specific type of rejection. It's a rejection that is required by our establishment because we know that you really will run risk when you talk about white identity. You don't have any problems in our society when you talk about black identity, Jewish identity, homosexual identity, female identity. There are no problems in our society. I mean, in academia, inside academia, because the feminists are so prevalent, yeah, they're going to give you some problems if you challenge their feminist ideology. But there are many outlets out there, book publishers. I mean, this is why Peterson has been in part so successful or has been embraced by mainstream conservatives because he's not saying things that challenge the entire globalist establishment. So I think that was a point that I wanted to make clear in that short article, and there are a few other points there.
Yeah, definitely. It seems that he's, I mean, he holds a double standard. I don't know how anyone can come from the perspective he does come from and claim that he can be outside of identity, right? Even these conservatives that have an idea of individuality and, you know, Western civilization and kind of a non-collectivist ideology is a kind of a collective identity or a collective ideology in itself, right? It means we stand together as individuals and we're never going to join a group. Well, guess what? You're part of that group that thinks like that. I mean, it's like it's a human condition. You can't enter outside of it.
Right. The idea of the us versus them is inbuilt into human beings.
Exactly.
And they should know that because Jordan Peterson is a psychologist and evolutionary psychology prevails in the discipline of psychology, which means that Darwinianism is very much a part of psychological thinking. So he knows well that we have this in-group, out-group distinction. But it looks like the one in-group that is prohibited is the white in-group. I also wanted to add another point, which is that I think in the Red Eyes news, because my article was picked up by Red Eyes, I noticed that you put a video there of Jordan Peterson in which, I mean, he's in tears as he defends individualism.
Yeah, this one right here that I'm playing.
Okay, that's the one.
Yep.
And I mean, you know, he's rejecting here the collectivism of communism and Nazism. And this is a mistake that people make. All these libertarians, they make this mistake. They think that collectivism is just an ideology and that it emerged with communism and Nazism, and they don't realize that these forms of collectivism, in the case of communism in particular, were imposed from above. They were not forms of collectivism that grew from the ground up. They were not forms of collectivism that had existed for hundreds and thousands of years among a people. The kind of collectivism that we on the outright support is a kind of collectivism of a people that have been in a place for a long time, that have their own heroes, their own language, mannerisms, and customs. And what we are saying is that they do exist as a collectivity, as a people. Now, it doesn't mean that they're uniform, particularly in the case of the West. The West is uniquely an individualistic nation. So, depending on what nation you're talking about, but to some degree or to a lesser or larger degree, some are more individualistic, some are more collectivist. But the West has always been, in varying ways throughout history, individualistic and collectivist at the same time. But Peterson is talking about this communistic, top-down imposition of collective values and then complete destruction of the traditions of Russia, the wrecking of the churches. When you talk about the Orthodox Christian tradition in Russia, you're talking about a form of collectivism and identity. That was crucial to their sense of what it means to be Russian. It was something that made them feel rooted, gave them a uniqueness, at least a sense of we are Russians. So it is very different from communism. So I think that has to be clear, that we understand that for traditionalists, for the outright, what we mean by collectivism is not an ideology that is imposed by an elite that is completely disassociated from the masses.
Yeah, it's a natural biological tendency that all groups have, and it's so infuriating that it's this always this double standards that we need to continue to point out to show that it's like, well, identity for thee, but not for, you know, for me or whatever, you know, but whatever group you belong to, right? It's strictly forbidden for white people to organize on a group group level. And the question, of course, is, well, how are you going to, as an individual, there's this famous kind of, I guess, meme he tweeted, I'll pull it up here in a second, but he is an individual knight. It's a kind of cartoon image where he's slaying the many heads of a dragon, right? And it's collectivism and Nazism, you know, socialism and all these things. So, but it's like, you can't, and I mean, it's even part of the article that you had to a certain extent of like, how do you protect the values of the West, right? If you think of the seminal moment of the 300 army, the Spartans, right, against the Persians, that's not individualism. That's a collective fighting and working together to keep the forces of invasion at bay, you know?
Yes, and I mean, his understanding of Western civilization is a very neocon understanding. He thinks the West is all about values. He says things like, oh, yes, you bet the West is the best. This is why everyone wants to come to our lands. This is typical of the conservative, a person who thinks the West is about rule of law, economic growth, standard of living, which is true. But it is a lot more than that. And it is about identity. It's about a sense of place. It's about understanding that there is so much variety among Western peoples already, whether it is the Finnish people, the Norwegians. You know, the Norwegians are winning the Olympics. I mean, they're a small nation. They're very good. The Swedish are doing very good, too. So in any case, it's about all those things. It's not just this kind of economistic definition combined with a few liberal values. it really is about physiognomy, the physiognomy of the peoples, the music, the heroes, the book, the great books, the historical accounts. There's so many things that make a people, and they're not talking about that. And there is no question that if you have nations with open borders, with hordes of immigrants arriving in, that is dramatically altering the identity of those nations, and they have every reason to oppose it.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many things that goes into it. The temperament that's creating a kind of a uniqueness, the geography of where the particular, you know, people or tribe has been located, that has helped to shape differences and stuff like that. And I mean, as you know, they're trying to rewrite all that things with fines such as Cheddar Man and all these things. It's a constant academic attack on our identity to say, well, you were either you were black skinned or you came out of Africa. And it's always this. And my argument is, you know, okay, well, let's look at it scientifically. If it's true, we know that there's so much didactic kind of propaganda within academia these days that you have to be wary and careful of what you believe in. You have to question everything. But even regardless, Ricardo, I mean, over time we have developed into a unique branch on the human evolutionary tree. And why is it that these proponents of diversity are still trying to cut those branches off and say, no, you're all this, like, back in line. We're all going to merge together and become this one group, when there's so many individual and beautiful, really, expressions of uniqueness in the branch of the human family, you know?
They share their man. It's a disaster, that argument. And I have an article that I think I published that article back in October sometime, but I address all these articles that have been saying that, oh, look, Europeans used to be dark and African in the past. I am of the view, well, fine. They were, because if you think of the first people who arrived, they were darker. I have no doubt about that. But this argument actually proves our point, which is that evolution did not stop once people left Africa 50, 60,000 years ago, and that in the continent of Europe, because it's a very different environment, there were different evolutionary pressures that led to different behavioral traits and physical traits emerging over time, so that Europeans actually emerge in Europe. They evolve in Europe. So they are unique to Europe. They cannot be found anywhere else. They are fundamentally indigenous to Europe. So this argument really destroys their claim that we are not indigenous, because at first we were darker, more African-like, but then evolution kept going on, and it even accelerated. As I already argued this in my book, Faustian Man. There is a chapter in which I say that evolution accelerated and that Europeans evolved right in the continent of Europe. Therefore, they are super indigenous to Europe.
Exactly.
So the whole argument, I sent this article to a bunch of the scientists that were cited by this woman, Anne Gibbons, who said that there is no such thing as pure European. It was an article that spread through the internet, and I went about to demonstrate that this article is total garbage, and I sent it to her, I sent it to the scientists, and either they ignored her, she tried to argue against me, but she knew she was just, I told her, you're just following an ideology because you don't like Germans and you want to see them completely mongrelized and so on. That's the article. So I have in my blog an attempt to refute that argument.
Yeah, and that's important. It's part of this kind of war, really, that we're involved in right now, of over identity and the rights being granted to us as a unique group, in the same way that it's being granted, and not only granted, it's being promoted as unique aspects worth preserving, basically. I mean, look at the promotion of, I mean, it's just contextual, but we're talking about current issues now. Black Panther, for example, right? The movie, these are things that are launched as, like, you know, it's meant to, you know, lift them up as a unique group.
Yeah.
They're better, you know, they're better than us. It's equality, but they're really better than us, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's being done with sci-fi in some cases, and in other cases, it's backed up by the Cheddar Man kind of fines and stuff like that. But the important thing, let's go back a little bit to Peterson and see how kind of he fits into that narrative. That why is it that, why do you think that he is denying that to white people, to Europeans? Is it because of is he leaning on the history of this, that he's saying, well, it will lead to these horrible things again, and it led to collectivism once in the past, so therefore we can't do it? or why? Because we have talked about clips where he's, you know, defending Jewish people as a group, for example, where they can have, you know, he argues that they're more intelligent and this kind of thing, and he seems to care for them and tend for them in a way that he doesn't for his own kind, you know.
Right. There was a guy. The letters like Jordan Peterson. You say JP, but you had a guy from Quebec. He said JF. Addressed his question of why Peterson can't. Remember when Peterson was asked that question, and he said, "I can't."
Exactly. Yeah. It was on the book, right? The Solzhenitsyn's book, I believe, and he was tying into it the ethnic interest.
And there was a guy that you interviewed recently. He's from Quebec. He has the Quebecois accent.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And his name is
Jean-François Galipieu, I think his name
is. Right.
Yeah.
So he specifically tried to answer why it is that he can't, Jordan Peterson. Mm-hmm. And he was quite good. He said that Jordan Peterson belongs to a generation in which it is really not possible. They've been so brainwashed and accustomed to the idea that there is something mean-spirited, evil about identity politics, talking about Jewish power and influence in our society. And I thought that was a good answer. He sort of said when it comes to economics, Peterson already has made a lot of money. He could continue to make money and possibly more. So he said he could have spoken about the Jewish issue. I would add, however, that it is not about money, but it is about adulation. Peterson is celebrated. He's on constant demand. This is something good. It feels good to any human being that people want to talk to you. They want to hear you. Your books are being sold everywhere. And I think he doesn't want to lose that. There's an element of that. But I would also say that the left has pushed their politics so far that they have created a very tense political situation. We see it with Trump now. Trump is just pushing a little bit, and you can see the incredible reaction of the left against it. Now imagine when we start pushing more. Imagine when we get leaders up there who say immigration is going to stop, legal immigration, who say that if there is identity politics for non-whites, I guess there's going to have to be identity politics for whites. We're going to have a really tense situation, and I think people like Jordan cannot contemplate that politics. They were born in an affluent society. They don't really know much about history. I mean, Jordan is a psychologist. He's very good. He knows psychology well. But history is an altogether different discipline that teaches you a lot of things. All of these people that we're going to examine, they're all psychologists. Pinker, Haidt, and Jordan are psychologists. They don't realize that in history we have seen a lot of struggles and civil wars, and that they're pushing whites against the wall, and they're pushing us into a situation in which we have to counter, we have to do whatever needs to be done to survive and preserve our identity, and they don't want to. Jordan Peterson doesn't want it. His mind cannot contemplate that possibility that there is going to be some real politics, you know, like Bismarck. Mm-hmm. Bismarck said, the politics of our times are not going to be decided by parliamentary debate. It's going to be about blood and iron. I'm not trying to sound dramatic because, in a way, the left is the one that's creating this situation. So they think, oh, you know, it's just going to be about me writing a book about 12 rules and changing a few minds and hide, if you read what he's saying, I just wish that conservatives and liberals get along and they talk to each other and that kind of stuff. Well, maybe that's the way it's going to be. I just doubt it. I think the situation is too tense. It's building up, and the left needs to be blamed for this. And so that would be one of the answers I would give.
Yeah, definitely. That is a good answer. And they're... On one end, you know, I feel that he's like, as I said before, he's there as a steam valve. He's there as kind of providing acceptable outlets of critique against postmodernism, against, to a certain extent, cultural Marxism and these kinds of things. He knows the university environment very well, and he's completely on point there. And as you said, I mean, this is not just simply about bashing the guy. This is saying, you know, he brings a lot of good focus and attention, necessary aspects of critique to the modern world, if you will. But there's so many other aspects that lies behind there, and the few times that he has been confronted on those, he seems unwilling to cross that threshold, almost,
yeah.
You know, in a not aggressive way, but it's like, as you said, it's like, I can't do it, I can't talk about it, that's it, you know. And so that's what people are going to push on, that's what they're going to focus on and say, well, why can't you? These are not unreasonable ideas, these are ideas just as all the other ones that you're discussing. So it is interesting, but, you know, I think you're right. I mean, to a certain extent, he is from that different generation, and he just cannot conceptualize that this would be something that's going to come. But again, the more these guys also become the gatekeepers of the real discontent coming out, if you will, I think it is going to be worse. I think that the Jordan Petersons, together with, you know, I would throw out someone like Sargon of Akkad, is that they are warning.
Yeah.
They're warning about the left for the reason that they think that the reaction to what they're doing is going to be far greater than what the left is doing now. They think either the left will turn into fascist, I guess they already argued that, or the opposition to the left are going to turn into fascist. So I guess they feel themselves between a rock and a hard place, I would figure. But it's like the more you avoid these issues, the more tension, if you will build up within society, right?
Yes, and in the end, I mean, a lot of these conservatives, when it comes down to it, they would side with the left.
I think so, too. Yep, I agree.
Yes, they are very much living it up. I mean, Hyde, Pinker, they have incredible lives within the existing order. They're enjoying themselves. Hyde is saying, you know, we just need to get together and talk to each other. So to me, that's just more of the same thing. And yeah, we can talk about Hyde and Pinker. And one of the things I notice about them is that in their case, more so than in the case of Peterson, they are now at a point in which they are basically saying to conservatives, no, they're saying to the left, as conservatives, they're saying to the left, look, listen to us. You may think, and you may even call us all right, we are not at all. You may say we dog whistle to whites and that kind of thing, but we don't. We actually are telling you, the left, that we have arguments that we think can defeat the alt-right, the populism, can defeat the followers of Trump. That's where they are now. I mean, Hyde and Pinker, right now, they are opposing writing against the alt-right. They're not so much anymore writing against the academic left. And they're telling the left, listen to us. That's what they're doing. Even in that video that now you might say, well, it was a very popular video in which a Pinker said that our right guys are savvy guys. They're intelligent guys. They're noticing things.
Should we listen to that, by the way?
Put that on.
Yeah, let's check this out.
I wouldn't want to say persuadable, but certainly whose affiliation might be up for grabs, comes from the often highly literate, highly intelligent people who gravitate to the alt-right, internet savvy, media savvy, who often are radicalized in that way, who swallow the red pill, as the saying goes, the illusion from the Matrix. When they are exposed to the first time to true statements that have never been voiced in college campuses or in the New York Times or in respectable media, that are almost like a bacillus to which they have no immunity. And they are immediately infected with both a feeling of outrage that these truths are unsayable, and no defense against taking them to what we might consider to be rather repellent conclusions. Let me give you some examples. So here is a fact that's going to sound ragingly controversial, but is not. And that is that capitalist societies are better than communist ones. Okay, so if you doubt it, then just ask yourself the question, would I rather live in South Korea or North Korea? Would I rather live in West Germany in the 1970s or East Germany or in the 1960s? So this is not, I submit that this is actually not a controversial statement, but in university campuses, it is considered flamingly radical. Number two, here's another one. Men and women are not identical in their life priorities, in their sexuality, in their tastes and interests. Again, this is not controversial to anyone who is even glanced at the data. The kind of vocational interest tests of a kind that your high school guidance counselor gave you have been given to millions of people. And men and women give different answers as to what they want to do for a living and how much time they want to allocate to family versus career and so on. But you can't say it. I mean, someone, a very famous person on this campus, did say it. And we all know what happened to him. And he's no longer, well, he is on this campus, but no longer in the same office.
All right, so he makes, as you say, he makes a comment about the alt-right. He knows about them. He's aware of it. He sees them as a competition in the rise of the critique against the dominant culture, which is, you know, left, right? So they see that they have to try to strike and kind of crush the head of the snake before it, yeah, it grows too big. That's what I see. And you even sent me one of the articles there, too, where he basically kind of backs up everything that Jordan is talking about, how identity politics is an enemy of reason and enlightenment, yeah, values, right?
Which is nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be writing an article about his book that just came out, Enlightenment Now, and I will address in more detail why I think his conception of reason and enlightenment is not an adequate one. But to go back to the video that you just showed, you can see clearly in that video that he's saying that we cannot simply just pretend that we don't have statistics on different crime behavior for blacks and whites. This is now in the open. White males are finding this stuff out. And so he's kind of saying that we conservatives, in being more open to some of these ideas about gender differences in criminal behavior between the races, that whites are going to be more satisfied, are going to feel like they are being heard, that they're not being taken for as fools, that the leftist strategy of outright suppression is just not going to work in the long run. So this is what he's saying. But then, as you just showed, that article, which is about the book he just wrote, which is, let me just get the full title of that book, mm-hmm, he just wrote. Unless you get it before me, but it's Enlightenment Now. Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Now, let me say some things about Pinker. Pinker, of the three people that we're examining, is legitimately an intellectual of high stature. He has two books that I would say are his best, The Language Instinct, and How the Mind Works, which he published in the 1990s. He did publish then later, I think it was 2006, if I remember, The Blank Slate, and that was a pretty good book. Then another one in 2010 or 2011, The Better Angels of Art, Nature, and now Enlightenment Now. There was another book in between there. The Better Angels is about, or make the argument that violence and homicide has declined considerably in the 20th century. So the 20th century, contrary to what leftists say, has been an age of progress and improvement for human beings.
Right.
In the book Enlightenment Now, he gets into many other statistics to show that when it comes to education, literacy, when it comes to health, when it comes to income, when it comes to standard of living, when it comes to criminal rate and homicide rate, that on all those statistics, the 20th century has seen an improvement across the world. And also when it comes to other less materialistic matters, such as human rights, sexism, homophobia, that there has been an improvement, particularly in the West. And that argument, in my view, is obvious. He says that people in the outright, like people in the left, they're pessimistic and they don't believe in this stuff. Well, that's not true. People, at least I, on the outright, have no problem saying that thanks to white technology and white science, things have improved considerably in terms of economic standing and health, longevity. People live longer than ever in the last 100, 200 years. And that China and India now, I mean, these places have massive populations, so you can see the statistics are really going to trend upwards when you count all those numbers, billions of people there in terms of health, standard of living. So we have no problem saying that that is a reality. But one of the things I did in preparation for this interview is that I began to examine other trends. And these trends are trends that relate to modernity. These are problems that are unique to the living conditions, not materialistic conditions, but just the whole way of life of our times. And they are particularly true in the West. And these are the things that people in the outright, people in the left too, are concerned about. So I'm just going to quickly go over some of these statistical trends that show that things are not as great as he presents them.
Right. Yep.
So, for example, here I have, people probably can't read this, but they know about it, traffic congestion. We know that in the last decade, the paper or article that I have here is that traffic congestion levels in the largest metropolitan areas have grown in almost every year in all population groups from 1982 to 2003, because this is when this study was done. But I know they have grown more since 2003. So this is something that people live through every year. So you can imagine they have great cars, a great job, you know, their standard of living is higher. They went to primary, secondary, maybe university education, so they're very literate. They live long, even though they're all stressed out. They're miserable waiting in those cars. The situation is pretty bad. So here I have other statistical trends. The state of childhood obesity. Again, this article says that childhood obesity has increased considerably since the 1970s. Then I have here, there is a startling increase in major depression among teens in the U.S. And, Time is publishing this, but the original study comes from Pediatrics, which is a scientific journal. It says that from 2005 to 2014, there has been a 37% increase in major depression among teens. Then we have here more studies about, like more specific studies about anxiety among children. It also has increased considerably. In the case of this study, it has increased considerably, I think, over the last 10 years. Anxiety and depression is higher. Another one, depression has soared in the past 25 years. It says here, rates of depression and anxiety among teenagers have increased by 70% in the past 25 years. Mental health crisis among teenage girls in particular. This is not necessarily depression, but it's all kinds of other psychological ailments that they're suffering through. The percentage of births out of wedlock by age and race. You can see the, I don't know if they can see the graph there, but it's going up and up and up in the last decades. 70% of black births to single mom have increased. You can see 70% black births to single moms. Loneliness is a global epidemic. This is concentrated on England, but it's becoming an epidemic across the world. Drug abuse,
yes,
opiates, all
correct.
Across the board. I mean, I could go on and on. So what I'm trying to say with these statistics is that we need to understand that just because a society improves dramatically over the last 100 years on a whole range of indicators, it doesn't mean that we don't get all the problems.
No, exactly.
People in the past always understood this. Affluence brings its own problems. We have problems among even young men, as you know, the fact that young men, you know, they don't have that sense of confidence that they did in the past, and a whole range of other problems. And these are the issues that people in the alt-right are addressing and are concerned about. And those are just a few issues. You can then go on to add a whole range of other new issues that are related to mass immigration, the rape epidemics across Europe, the terroristic attack, the constant harassment against whites, the fact that whites are not given a right to have their own identity. And then that argument by Pinker, you can demolish it right away, because the argument is no big deal. Yeah, oh, wow, so in the Industrial Revolution and modern science improved the standing of living of peoples. But that's, we agree on that. Point is, something is going on, and Pinker is trying to obscure that. He's trying to hide it from us. He's saying globalization is good, because really, in his book, he's just defending globalization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's saying globalization is good. Guys, calm down. You know, don't worry about it. And that's what he's doing. And it's not good. And this gets to the philosophical foundation of his argument. Human beings are not defined just by material well-being.
Exactly.
There are many other things that matter to us, and one of them that really matter to us is a sense of being rooted, a sense of identity and cohesion. And many of these depressions that people are suffering from and taking drugs left and right is because of that. It's because they don't have that sense that I know what the meaning of my life is, I know who I am, I have a sense of attachment and pride in my people. All of that has been taken away from them. So Pinker, his argument is just a globalist argument, and it has to be seen in that light.
There's so many things which you've just mentioned, but they are important and very vital keys to understand not only what he's trying to oppose with the alt-right, but also just kind of a simplistic view, frankly, of the progression that we've seen since after the Industrial Revolution. Because as we know, there's always a trade-off, Ricardo. There's always like, okay, maybe you have had less, you know, direct, conflicts in terms of the like a world wars and this kind of stuff. But the conflicts have, rather than being these big centralized kind of wars, they have trickled down into much more tribal conflict in some cases, internally due to globalization, right? There's been, with material comforts and all these kinds of things and progress in materialism, as you say, there is a spiritual hole that's opened up, if you will, a shallowness where people don't feel belonging anymore. And just one more point on that. Those are studies that are backed up by other people, such as Robert Putnam, right, that did the long-term and the short-term effects of multiculturalism, where he basically argues that, well, in the long term, it's going to be great. We're all going to be similar. We're going to get along and all this stuff. But there is interviews with him where he stands and talks about, unfortunately, though, in the short term, it creates people to be like, closed off. They close off. They don't go out as much. They become much more inclined to consume, right, into empty consumerism and stuff like that. These are real vital problems, which I think the Pinkers of the world, either they're just disingenuous because they have an agenda to push, or they just simply don't get that it's like, it's not only about those things. It's about, you know, the challenges of life, the act of overcoming something as a young man, and even, you know, the act of going on an adventure. You know, in the past, they went out on boats and discover new lands. To a certain extent, there was war weaved into that too, of having a great challenge that you take up and overcome. Much of this has been, I don't know what to call it, outsource, has disappeared. They're no longer there. Everything is so managed and controlled to offer people almost a kind of a sheltered existence. But the consequence of it has been, I believe, depression, increase in drug use, isolation, and with the internet, which supposedly is to connect everybody, there is a kind of we're more isolated than ever. And these are real problems, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the world that Pinker wants is, he has to understand that he's ultimately relying on a value judgment as to what he considers a good life. Many people don't have to agree with him. You can easily say, to me, a good life is not just longevity, health, even though I could be obese and they keep me alive for a long time. That's not what life is all about. There, as you just said, there are many other things that are incredibly important, including risk-taking, including the fact that you strive for things that other people haven't striven for, that you're willing to fight at the cost of risk for a cause, and that gives meaning and purpose to your life. He doesn't see that. He has, you know, I don't want to get too controversial here, but his view of the meaning of life, you can say at the least, is a bourgeois Philistine conception that betrays something that Westerners have always valued, which is a sense of honor, a sense of courage, pride, and just the exuberance of living for something that is greater than yourself. He just thinks it's about having a nice little comfortable place. And I mean, I'm not denying that that's not important. Sure. If you are without food and without heat, then of course that's very important. But we know that affluence brings its own problems, and that there is something about it in our society. I mean, you're showing these images that is very alienating. It really is not necessarily the perfect best life as Pinker wants to pretend. And I think Pinker also, in a very calculating way, he now feels that the greatest threat is white identity, not the leftist academics, because in his writings about this book, I have yet to read the book, I read quite a bit about it, the last book, it seems to me that he's sort of saying, oh no, the academics are not that bad and that kind of thing. So, you know, we have to see where he's coming from.
Yeah, and I mean, we should point out he's Jewish, Steven Pinker, and there's a question in this Weekly Standard here. The first thing that his interviewer, Adam Rubinstein, is asking him is the following. If reason is to be the currency of our discourse, what's the future of identity politics? Is identity politics based in reason? Your new book touches on the issue, but curiously, could you provide more information, offer an explanation of identity politics, where it comes from where it's going, and what we should think about it? And Pinker says in the article, well, identity politics is a syndrome in which people's beliefs and interests are assumed to be determined by their membership in groups, okay, particularly their sex, race, sexual orientation, and disability status. And he continues to say, its signature is the tick of preceding a statement with as a and something, as if that bore on the cogency of what was to follow. Identity politics originated with the fact that members of certain groups really were disadvantaged by their group membership, which forged them into a coalition with common interests. And then he says, Jews really did have a reason to form the Anti-Defamation League, right? So he recognizes that one group here is present, and that there is a value, I guess, in organizing for your own self-interest as a group, right?
Oh, yeah. And he's endorsing the leftist view. He's basically saying if you have been discriminated against, then you have a right for identity politics. And presumably whites have never been discriminated against.
Jeez.
And therefore they don't have a right for identity politics. Also notice that the two issues, the slave trade and the Holocaust, this is something that's directed against whites. They are deep, harmful things, and they need to sit there. He thinks it's not enough the amount of times this has been repeated across every nation in European lands, but they need to keep sitting there and hearing about the nasty things they did to other groups. I mean, you know, this is nonsense. There are so many other groups that have suffered. We can talk about Holodomor. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah.
Ukrainians suffered a lot. What about their right to identity politics?
Right.
There are all kinds of things going on here.
It's a shallow view of history. And again, you said he's not a historian, he's a psychologist, and that could play into it, because then you would assume that somehow white identity, or as the left calls it, white supremacy, of basically being white people being supreme in their own countries and running things, right? That's a problem for them. But that would entail that there was never any kings or authoritarian leadership in European countries that never showed any harm towards their own people. What I'm saying is that European society traditionally I believe, never had this idea of, well, this is white society and we're going to bring whiteness to the planet. No, it was much more tribal than that, much more later nationalistic than that also. But even the people inside of those nations, they did suffer. There was the poorer classes were obviously much more difficult, in a difficult situation. And it wasn't that the leadership said, well, hold your horses, they're white, so they're going to get all the benefits that we have as kings and queens. I mean, that's kind of silly, isn't it?
He's decided, I mean, in choosing those two examples, which are the standard examples of the establishment, of the left, he has decided what identity politics can be allowed and what cannot be allowed. So Jews have a right to identity politics and blacks have a right to it, whites don't. If anything, whites are the ones who committed these crimes, therefore they are the least ones who have any right to identity politics. You see that this as well, there is a talk that he gave to a Jewish organization, I think it was in 2002, Pinker, and he addressed the question of a higher Jewish IQ on average than other groups. And right there, this is identity politics. He's saying that Jews, as a group, on average, have a higher IQ than whites. And he was comparing them to whites. He wouldn't compare them to blacks because he knows that's risky. But he felt, okay, I can just say it openly here, that on average we're smarter than whites. And so to me, this is identity politics in one way or another. You're saying that a group has certain identifiable group characteristics. So we could say the same thing about the Germans. We can say the Germans have certain identifiable cultural, ethnic characteristics that we value and we cherish. And there is no question that he values and is proud of the higher average IQ of the Jews. Now, we can ask on another talk why it is that whites have accomplished so much more than any other ethnic group and they build the greatest nations in the world. That's another topic. But you can see there that there is identity politics going. So in a way, we on the outright, what we're calling for is fairness. And this brings us, maybe if we can start talking about height.
I think, Ricardo, before we do, we should take a break. We're vastly running out of time here in the first segment.
Okay.
And the reason is, so let's save that after the break, talk about height, because that fits right in line to what we're talking about. But let's plug the book a little bit here at the end of the first segment, Ricardo, so we can actually get people to pick up a copy and go into it. Is there any, obviously we're talking about very three distinct kind of people here. Is there any overlap in the book in terms of what we're discussing? Tell us a bit more about the topics you address.
Yeah, in this book, I don't talk about Peterson or Hyde. This is something that I'm investigating right now. So this book is about Canada, and as I said at the beginning, it is a book that people that are not from Canada can really benefit from, because I do try in part four to offer a general explanation as to why the West decided to diversify itself. What were the reasons for that? So I would encourage people from outside Canada to purchase it, and if possibly to purchase it from Amazon Canada, so we can keep that ranking nice and high there, so the establishment can finally pay attention to it, because I have no support. No university, no academic says anything about it. They are hiding it, suppressing it, newspapers, no attention. So this is just readers out there. So I do need reader support, and it is simply a way of getting the message out. I would also say that my books in the past, as you know, you interviewed me a few times about them, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization is a book that tries to explain what makes the West so different. It is a very, heavy-going book. It's very scholarly. This one is more readable, although it is very well-researched. And then I have Faustian Man in a Multicultural Age that is a lot more readable. So I have those two other books.
Excellent, Ricardo. Yeah, I definitely want people to pick up a copy of it. Support Ricardo's work is very important. He's one of the few academics that are speaking out on this level that he is. And, of course, he is not limited to for whatever reason, restraints, if I can put it that way, that the Petersons, that the Pinker, that the Hydes has. So that's even more so important. I'm glad that it's on the bestseller list. Did it arrive there recently, you said, or has it been there for a while?
From the very beginning.
Oh, okay, great. That's awesome. So yeah, let's keep it there. I guess people can buy it through the CEA. I don't know if that takes some, if that changes the shipping at all. We can check that later and see if it changes. I don't think so, frankly.
Maybe they can support it by writing a review of endorsement if they like it after they read it.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely, folks. All right. Very good. So we'll have links to the latest book and to the previous books as well. And we've talked about them on the show in the past, folks. So definitely check out the archives, much more with Ricardo there. But yeah, great stuff. Let's just take a short break. Then we'll be right back, tie this conversation into Hike and continue. All right. There we go. First part with Ricardo Duchesne. Please join us in the second as we continue at redicemembers.com. If you haven't already, head on over there, sign up for a membership. And tune in not only to this continuation, but to all the shows going back to 2006, including exclusive videos and also our Weekend Warrior show, the news roundup of the week. We have actually another one here going up a little bit later today. Another good show, so definitely don't miss that. But yeah, the second part is actually really good. We continue to discuss Jonathan Haidt as the last party of these three guys that we've been talking about, the gatekeepers, if you will. And we also talk more about his book on Canada in Decay. So excellent stuff coming up. Please join us, redicemembers.com. We'll see you there. We'll be right back after a short break.